Today in Studio 360, as a young man in the 1960s, Brian Wilson took the cotton candy genre of surf rock and out of it made pop music masterpieces.
God only knows what I'd be without you.
Then pretty much disappeared from public view. Now John Cusack stars in a new movie about the Beach Boy auteur called Love and Mercy. To try to feel the genius, Cusack studied the songs.
We listened to everything and immersed ourselves just in his music to the point where, you know, we were just breathing it.
My conversation with John Cusack about playing Brian Wilson and about some of his 70-odd other movie roles. And we'll have a live performance from the great young Montreal band Braids. I'm Kurt Anderson. That and much more is ahead this hour in Studio 360. But to start the show today, during an interview on ESPN Radio last week, Jerry Seinfeld said he had had it with younger audiences whose offendedness meters are dialed up too high.
I don't play colleges, but I hear a lot of people tell me don't go near colleges. They're so PC. Hey, I'll give you an example. My daughter's 14. My wife says to her, well, you know, in the next couple of years, I think maybe you're going to want to hang around the city more on the weekends so you can see boys. You know, my daughter says, she says, that's sexist.
You know, it's amazing.
That they just want to use these words. That's racist. That's sexist.
And it's not just Seinfeld. Last month, Louis C.K., in his opening monologue on Saturday Night Live, outraged some people by joking about mild racism and Israel and Palestine and pedophilia. So are comedy and humor being suffocated by over-the-top PC sensitivities? Or are Seinfeld et al. Just out of touch? I figured Alexis Wilkinson could clue me in. She is a writer for HBO's Veep, and until about 5 minutes ago, an undergraduate editor and ex-president of the Harvard Lampoon. Alexis, welcome to Studio 360.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So, Jerry Seinfeld won't play colleges. Last year, Chris Rock said he wouldn't play colleges anymore either. And now Seinfeld's upset people by saying that people get too easily upset. Alexis, what's the matter with kids these days?
Oh, I don't know. The youth and their sensibilities. I had found myself sort of backed into a corner by groups and, you know, not even realizing like, what, that was offensive. Like, who does that offend? Why, you know, that doesn't make any sense to me. You know, all you can do is say, okay, I'll learn from that and go on. And I think the other thing is a lot of comedians their egos are so huge. And I think that's why a lot of times, I mean, besides the other issues of, you know, sexism and whatever in the industry, is that you see these are old white guys who have never had anybody really try to call them on anything. And it's just so upsetting that somebody tries to tell them what to do. Like, oh my God, yeah. No, you don't get to tell me what's funny. I'm, you know, the universal funny. I know everything. And it's just, you know, that's just not how it is anymore. And somebody might call you out and you might have to apologize. I know it's crazy that you might have to say sorry or, you know, really sort of dial back. But that's actually what happens now.
Well, and they long since graduated out of ever probably or being heckled. And this is not heckling, of course. It's not a drunk guy saying, you suck. It's people righteously being morally indignant. It's we don't know the correct lines yet in this new world, right?
Right, yeah. I think, and I mean, I learn new things all the time about both just the history of things that I might want to consider before topping up topic or certain words that are offensive to different groups of people that you don't think about. That's just part of the game now. And, you know, that's what people expect. People expect you to take that into account when you're talking.
Right.
And either you do that or you, again, don't, no one's forcing you to go to colleges. I don't really care if he goes to colleges or not.
Right.
You know, no one's, you know, they probably don't pay that much anyways. Don't do your big shows around people who totally get it and came up in the same era that you did. But that doesn't mean that comedy now is terrible. Like people like Louis C.K. being one of them who can talk about controversial topics, people like Amy Schumer, you know, all these people who are really getting at tough topics, but nobody is calling for them to be burnt at the stake or anything. It's because they're thinking about it. They're actually thinking about it.
Well, but it's, we're also in an age, and I suppose we always have been, but even more, where different people doing comedy because of their race, gender, ethnicity, sexuality, whatever, are permitted to do, to make certain kinds of humor more easily than others, right? I mean, as an African-American, as a woman, you can presumably get away with saying things and not as easily offending people because of your standing as that person.
That's totally true. But like Jewish people make Jewish jokes all the time.
Yep.
You know, Seinfeld of all people should be familiar with the idea that like half of the things that a lot of Jewish comics say, if coming out of somebody else's mouth, will be completely anti-Semitic.
Right. And also, I mean, sometimes whatever is said, some people are going to take offense, and you just have to understand that that's part of the gig, is that there's going to be people who find you offensive.
Right, right. And I mean, that's comedy. And no matter what, there's always some way to take a joke in an offensive way. But for me, I think it's finding the fine line between, oh, somebody's always going to get offended, I don't care if anybody gets offended, and, oh my God, I can't say anything because somebody might get offended.
Right.
Maybe I do need to say, hey, my bad, I'll work to be better in the future. And I know people kind of poo-poo that in general, especially in comedy, but I think in general, people respect being able to just own up to your stuff and move on instead of like deleting all your tweets and making snide, passive-aggressive comments about it later. Like, people will forget about it quicker than you think.
Well said. You are a wise young person, Alexis Wilkinson.
The youth aren't all bad, I'm telling you.
You've convinced me. You've convinced me. I'm back with the youth. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Alexis Wilkinson is a writer for Veep. So, listeners, how about you? We have an assignment for you along these lines. Tell us a joke or a line of dialogue or some piece of humor or comedy that is close to the line and that some people would find offensive, but that you find so funny, it's okay. Let us know at studio360.org.
You can't blame the youth. You can't fool the youth. You can't blame the youth. Of today, you can't fool the youth. You're teaching youths to learn in school. That cow jump.
By my count, John Cusack has made upwards of 70 movies over the last 30 years. 70. From the young, love-struck, boombox-wielding heartthrob in Cameron Crowe's 1989 film Say Anything, to Richard Nixon in Lee Daniels' The Butler. Along the way, his signature brand of puppy dog, underdog, everyman has made and kept him a star. And here is the latest, and also very fine performance he can add to his list of roles. Cusack takes on the real-life rock and roll icon Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys in the new film Love and Mercy. John Cusack, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks for having me.
You play Brian Wilson, the genius auteur of the Beach Boys. You play him when he's in his 40s in the 1980s, reclusive and under the care of his real-life controlling, sinister shrink, Dr. Eugene Landy. I want to play a clip from that part of the film. This is Dr. Landy and Brian going out to buy a Cadillac.
Do you know who this man is? Brian Wilson. Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys.
Ah. You didn't mention that.
Well, because that stuff doesn't matter. That's ego stuff, you know?
Are you kidding me? I love your music. I grew up on it. So thank you.
That makes me feel really good, Melinda Ledbetter.
Okay.
Melinda
good enough.
Ledbetter.
Right? It's a nice name. Why don't you get started on the paperwork, okay?
That is Paul Giamatti as Dr. Landy, you as Brian Wilson, and Elizabeth Banks as the Linda Ledbetter who becomes his girlfriend. How did you figure out how to play this guy? I mean, especially because he's a genius. He was famously mentally ill in the past. He's still living. It's a complicated thing.
It's a really complicated thing. And I think the key to it is that, you know, he's a complete paradox, which is he's on some level, he's just he's a feeling intuitive kind of a person. So he's like a heart with two legs that's walking around. But then he's really tough, you know, can endure a lot, is still here, and he's got an incredible kind of mental discipline. And he's a bit like a Cheshire Cat in that he knows exactly what's going on, but I think kind of like Bob Dylan in a way, he's there, but he's not there because everybody wants to know about his genius. So he has this defense mechanism from being famous and sensitive for so long that just when you think you have him pegged, he surprises you and can do the opposite. The power's in the paradox with Brian in a weird way.
Yeah.
And then he's there, so he's still alive, so you can talk to him and ask him some things, and you can ask him.
And you did?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And he wanted to he wants you to feel it, and right. He wanted it to feel true, and he also wanted to approach the mental difficulties that he had, because I think there was a stigma to it, and he was misdiagnosed.
Right.
And
more of a stigma in the 60s, 70s, and 80s than probably now.
Yeah. But he's just a unformatted, completely unformatted, yeah. free-spirited person who you know, there's not many like him.
Yeah. Paul Dano plays the younger Brian in the film, the Brian in his early 20s who created Pet Sounds and so forth. I was surprised to read that the two of you didn't, like, try to figure it out. How are we going to do this guy? Could it not worked? Totally worked. The two of you, different people, playing this guy, not that far apart in age. But how come you didn't, like, you know, make him jive in advance somehow?
We know we can't. There is no definitive portrait of Brian Wilson, and certainly not in 2 hours.
Yeah.
And certainly not just in one book. And so, like, we could both write, you know, I could ask my family and I'd say, let's all write a book about my mom, and it would be 4 different versions of the same mother. So the conceit is that we're admitting that this is an album or 2 songs about Brian that hopefully, you know, so we didn't want to, like, compare notes and try to do the same character. We wanted my take based on Brian, you know, when he was trying to come out of the abyss of that terrible time in his life and Paul's before. And we hoped if we just used the music as the source, and we all went back to the Smile sessions and the music, that these two, you know, voices would harmonize into a nice song, maybe, if it works.
Well, and the director...
But it's a big leap of faith. But, you know, again, if you're making a movie about Brian Wilson, you can't go with some formatted... I mean, this is a guy who is a conjurer, an explorer, so...
And a big risk taker, so take a risk.
You have to take a risk. So it was more like... it wasn't saying, like, Paul and I can't talk to each other. We just kind of...
Yeah.
We just sort of looked at each other and... But he said he came by. He was finishing up as I was starting, and we overlapped. And he came by my trailer, and he heard me blasting the Smile Sessions. And I found out, we talked later, that, you know, since the Smile Sessions was the lost classic that he couldn't perform, and that it broke his heart that people didn't want him to do it, we used that both as the fulcrum for this movie in a strange way. We listened to everything and immersed ourselves just in his music to the point where, you know, we were just breathing it.
Yeah. As somebody who has immersed themselves in his music, I want to play a song, a Beach Boys song for you. 50 years later, this is God Only Knows, and maybe you can talk over it and say, tell us, in your view, why this music was so revolutionary.
I may not always love you, but long as there are stars above you.
Paul McCartney said this was the greatest song ever written. Even George Martin, and this is a guy who produced Lennon and McCartney and the Beatles, said this is the greatest composer, songwriter, producer in the history of modern music.
Yeah.
So the complexity, the purity. And this song was written in response to Rubber Soul. So Brian heard Rubber Soul. And he said, oh, my God, I've got to go write something. And he wrote this in 45 minutes.
God only knows what I'd be without you.
When the Beatles heard this, there was this back and forth, and it was almost like a friendly awe competition between the two. But when you think that George Martin, Lennon, McCartney, you know, there was a group, and even though it might not have been easy in the Beatles camp, they were all on the same page, and they were all working together. And Brian was doing all this with one ear in Los Angeles. It's extraordinary, but it also feels a little bit like sacrilege talking over Brian Wilson.
Okay.
God only knows what I'd be without. God only knows what I'd be without.
So I thought we would play this game we sometimes do with actors. I say the name of 10 of your films, and you just say the first thing that pops into your head.
Okay.
Okay?
Should I be in the polite, witty, brutally honest, or actually just incoherent mode?
I like all of
them. Because it's usually a kind of a mixture.
The mixture is fine.
And then also...
light on the incoherent, but otherwise fine.
Egomaniacal?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Please.
Self-involved?
Yes.
All right.
Okay.
And self-pitying?
That could work as a slight piece of the mix.
All right. Yeah. Okay. I'll throw it all
okay.
in.
Stand by Me.
Stephen King.
Say Anything.
The Clash.
Gross Point Blank.
Joe Strummer.
Con Air.
Sandals. Sandals. You want one word?
No, it can be a phrase.
Oh, first revolutionary cartoon action figure, first sandal-wearing, non-Charlton Heston action figure in the modern era, milestone achievement, turn the mic off.
Being John Malkovich.
It's hard being a puppeteer in today's wintry economic climate.
High Fidelity.
Chicago.
Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil.
Savannah.
I could have said that.
I know. Okay, The Lady Chablis.
Nice. 2012.
Press Tour.
Hot Tub Time Machine.
An attempt to make something both profoundly dumb and intelligent.
Modern Culture in a Nutshell. At its best.
Oh, hey. I don't know about that. But yes.
The Butler.
Ellsberg.
Thank you. You win.
I did?
Yeah.
But I think I actually managed to both ruin it and win.
Well, there you go. I want to play a clip from one of my favorite films of yours, which is Spike Jonze's first film, Being John Malkovich.
There's a tiny door in my office, Maxine. It's a portal, and it takes you inside John Malkovich. You see the world through John Malkovich's eyes, and then after about 15 minutes, you're spit out into a ditch on the side of the New Jersey Turnpike.
Yeah.
Sounds great. Who the f*** is John Malkovich?
That is you explaining to your coworker how you ended up inside John Malkovich. Being John Malkovich, to me, is one of the great, weird, funny films of all time. How did you come to be involved in it?
This is going to sound insane, but it's going to sound like me, which probably is insane. But when my agents at the time, I said, you know, they said, well, we want to talk to the literary department and like tell me the scripts. I said, tell me your scripts that just no one will ever make and just the weirdest thing you have. And they said, well, you know, well, there's this or this or this. I go, no, I'm talking about like, you know, come on, what's the script that just cannot be made and is the sickest, craziest? And then, well, there's Charlie Kaufman. And I said, oh, who? And so I just said,
huh.
And so an agent there at the time, you know, it was one of those kind of scripts that was a legendarily weird script.
So sometimes movie star hubris is a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And then I just said, you know, get me first in the door.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like that.
You co-wrote and starred in High Fidelity in 2000. I want to play a clip from that film. This is you as Rob, the record store owner, with your sister, your older sister Joan, who plays your friend Liz.
You have got to stop calling her. You're really upsetting her and him.
I care about him.
Well, you should.
Why?
Because all you're doing is forming a little unit. Them against you. Before you started all this psychotic madness, there was no unit. There was just three people in a mess. But now they've got something in common. And you don't want to make anything worse.
How could it get any worse than Laura with Ian? Come on, Liz.
Rob. Can I ask you a question, and you can think about it if you want to?
Just what is it?
Why do you want Laura back so badly?
That is Joan Cusack and John Cusack in High Fidelity. I've got two sisters I love. I'm not sure I would want to work with them for weeks and months on a project. Is it completely great and frictionless when you two work together, which you've done more than once?
Well, yeah, because she's more talented than me, right? And if that was my movie, right? So, like, I've produced it. And,
yeah.
And
do you really think she's more talented than you?
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
not
yeah.
just brotherly humility, you know?
No. She's the most gifted performer in the family for sure.
Yeah.
And so it's if you're just thinking it in pure mercenary terms, I can get her cheap, right? She'll show up.
Yeah.
Like if I call her, she'll show up to work, right?
You know, and there's no handling and begging and
No. And it's fact, she doesn't really even answer the phone, so I have to go to her house to talk to her.
That's cute.
And if I give her a good part and I say, okay, you can work in Chicago and just come here, okay, she'll do it. And then anytime you do a scene with her, it's usually the audience's favorite scene in the movie or one of the audience's favorite scene in the movie. So then all boats rise. She does the heavy lifting and, you know, you don't have to explain anything to her. You just put the camera on her and then you just hold on. And so it's like, why
would win?
Yeah, everybody wins.
Yeah. Your sister also retains a much thicker Chicago accent than you do. You grew up in a Chicago suburb. You've lived around there forever. And you're about to shoot this Spike Lee movie set there called Chi-Raq, Chi-Town plus Iraq, which I was too stupid to understand until I read it about 10 times. The title has created a brouhaha of controversy in Chicago from political leaders who think it's blasphemous. What do you make of that?
I think, out of respect to Spike Lee, I'll let him present his film the way he wants to. But I can say that I'm very sure that the city of Chicago can survive a film of conscience just like it did Transformers.
I'm sure it can. John Cusack, thank you very much. It was a great pleasure talking to you.
You too, man.
Love and Mercy is out right now. Coming up, school's out, which means it's time for us to kick off our latest listener challenge for high school students.
Every kid is funny, and then every kid gradually stops being funny, and then the ones that kept being funny are the ones who are comedians.
The actor, comedian, and author BJ Novak wants you, or at least your kids, to make him laugh. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Every so often on the show, we offer creative competitions, what we call extra credit challenges, that let you show off your talents or try new things. And our latest one is just for high school students. We're teaming up with the Scholastic Art and Writing Awards to find the best humor writing by teenagers. We're calling this challenge Funny Ha Ha. Here is the assignment. We will give you the first and last lines of your piece of writing, and the rest is entirely up to you. You can submit it as a regular prose text or in audio or video. The actor and writer BJ Novak is going to be our judge, and he is here with me right now. Welcome back, BJ.
Thank you.
So you, sir, have written a lot of humorous things in various media. You wrote for The Office. You've written for The Mindy Project. You wrote a great kids book, a funny, smart book of short stories. Thinking back to when you were a young person, when did you know that you were funnier than other people?
Well, I'll crib a line from Jerry Seinfeld, who said that every kid is funny, and then every kid gradually stops being funny. And then the ones that kept being funny are the ones who are comedians. So I thought, a funny kid, but so were all of my friends as far as I was concerned. We were always coming up with pranks and jokes and making fun of the teachers in little scripts that we would write and pass back and forth. It seemed to me that everyone was funny in the years that you're asking these students to submit from it in those years. But it was later that people sort of outgrew that, and I just thought, hey, where'd everybody go?
Yeah. Was there a book or a TV show or something at the time that knocked your socks off so much and made you say, well, no, I want to keep doing this, whatever my friends do?
Yeah, well, when I was really young, you know, like second, third, fourth grade, there was a Canadian show on Nickelodeon called You Can't Do That on Television.
Right.
And I thought that was the funniest, most interesting thing I had ever seen. And then when I got a little older, sort of that very formative age of around 10, 11, 12, The Simpsons started. And that was really something that really the early days of The Simpsons really blew everyone away.
Yep.
Because it was this all-American canvas of satire that was very rebellious and very smart at the same time.
Has your sense of humor changed significantly now that you are old?
I don't think so, actually. I notice more and more the patterns of what I write and what I'm drawn to in comedy tend to be what I've always been drawn to, which is sort of using intelligence against the people that are supposed to be the smart ones.
Uh-huh.
Or even a concept that a phrase that everyone says all the time that you think, why do people say this stupid thing? You know, anything that is taken as wisdom that you as the underdog can kind of illuminate that there's another way to think about it.
Right.
That's what sort of the mischievous teen in me was always doing comedy about. And I think that's still what I try to do.
So we have this humor writing challenge we're calling Funny Ha Ha. High school students can submit their work in any form they'd like, including the riskier performance versions, I guess, on audio or video or normal old-fashioned prose text, whatever. But every entry must start and end with particular lines, and I will invite you to read them.
The first line, the sun rose and everything fell. The last line, Alex stared at the door handle and slowly turned the knob. What happens in between those two lines is up to you.
And so in general, what advice would you give to high school humorists who want to try their hand?
Great comedy is the same as a great mystery or a great brain teaser, a great riddle, something that is so obvious that you never would have thought of. So I would say try to surprise people with something that they knew but never put their finger on. I'll quote Jerry Seinfeld again. He said that comedy is like jumping from one rooftop to another. If the buildings are too close together, there's no fun in the jump. But if they're too far apart, you're not going to make it. You got to find something that's just surprising enough to get a thrill, but not so surprising that it doesn't make sense to. It's just, and you know it when you feel it, you know? You know it when someone laughs.
So after we get our deluge of entries and you've judged them, you'll come back and announce the winners or winner?
I will.
Great. Thank you so much for doing this, PJ.
I look forward to the entries.
And high school students, you can send us your work and find out all the details about our challenge at studio360.org/funnyhaha. Your deadline is August 3rd. Last month, for the first time ever, a Twitter account became a Broadway play, a one-man show, starring God. Sean Ramosferam, host of our podcast Sideshow, explains.
Everyone is trying to be funny on Twitter, even Taco Bell. And that makes it a lot harder to actually be funny. The competition's really stiff. But one account that's been consistently hilarious since it opened in 2010 is the Tweet of God.
When I wrote that homosexuality was an abomination, that was before I saw Chris Pine. Hashtag hot, hashtag Golden Globes.
The guy behind the Tweet of God is David Jabberbaum, a.k.a. DJ. DJ's written for the Harvard Lampoon, The Onion, The Letterman, The Stewart. He's got Peabody's, Emmys, and a Grammy, but not the big bushy beard that his God avatar does. Since DJ started tweeting as God in 2010, tons of similar accounts have popped up on Twitter, but for my money, his remains the best by far.
The new Ten Commandments. 1. Laugh. 2. Read. 3. Say please. 4. Floss. 5. Doubt. 6. Exercise. 7. Learn. 8. Don't hate. 9. Cut the bull. 10. Chill.
The Tweet of God has 2 million followers, which means DJ gets thousands upon thousands of notifications every week, even when he doesn't tweet.
It's only work if you choose to let yourself get sucked into it, which I have, or if you find yourself unable to stop, which I do.
Little known to most of those 2 million followers is that DJ opened the account to promote a book, A New Testament for the Modern Age. He just hadn't written it yet.
And by the time the book had come out a year later, the account was well known enough that people thought the book was an attempt to capitalize on the Twitter account, when in fact it was the reverse. It was the tail wagging the god.
DJ's book finally came out in 2012. He called it The Last Testament, A Memoir by God. Unfortunately, it didn't do nearly as well as the Twitter account.
That's a shame, because God's previous books have sold in the billions, and he's told me that he's disappointed in the sales of this current book, and I explained to him that there's a new publishing paradigm and that digital has really undercut a lot of book sales.
DJ got over the disappointing sales, and he figured out a third act for his godliness, a Broadway show. Yes, there is now a big Broadway show based on a Twitter account. It's called An Act of God.
See, I was God, but I wasn't really godding, you know? I wasn't creating or destroying or judging anybody, which was something I'd always wanted to try.
An Act of God is an almost one-man show starring Jim Parsons from The Big Bang Theory. Jim plays God, or at least the regular dude God temporarily possesses in order to speak to the audience.
I had enough material to craft something, to have the basis of something, but then the challenge was, and the fun challenge was, to shape it into something that was a theatrical event and rather than just a series of a guy reading a series of one-liners.
Okay. And when I see some backup wide receiver from Dip University on SportsCenter point to me after scoring a touchdown, that cheapens the brand. This one's very simple. I'm not with you when your team wins. I'm not against you when your team loses. I'm not with or against you when you win or lose. I am not a Laker or a Cowboy or a Red Wing or, and please listen carefully to this one, I am not a Yankee, okay?
Not all, but a lot of comedy people have a soft spot for musical theater.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of them do it ironically and do it sort of in an undercutting way, but that counts.
Yeah.
That absolutely counts. I do it in the same way myself. There's something really cool about people breaking into song.
Yeah.
Having said that, I should make it clear that An Act of God is not a musical. It
right.
It is, for the most part, it is a straight play.
But it's more than a sort of just tongue-in-cheek joke. That's
Oh, yeah. 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 No,
there,
no.
There's some poignancy to it.
No, there's some poignancy to it, and there's a great deal of theatricality to it if we're doing our jobs right.
Right.
But there's not a huge amount of singing and dancing.
Right. Well, as a comedy writer, was it really surprising to you when you started the Twitter account, at least, or even when you wrote the book, that no one had really done this the way you've now done it before?
No one had tried to do it in a way that had really been picked up on in this particular way.
Right.
And I found it surprising because it seemed like relatively low-hanging fruit, low-hanging forbidden fruit.
And you'll react to, like, the Oscars, and you'll react to, I don't know, maybe the Super Bowl. I might be wrong.
Yes, Oscars, Super Bowl.
Yeah. The big things that people tweet about.
I had a Pacquiao Mayweather.
Sure.
Like anything, and I think that's true across the board for Twitter, is that things that get the most retweets and the things that get the most attention for anybody are the things that are the way you're reacting to a communal experience.
Yes.
So it's a compliment to television, basically, is what it is.
Bruce Jenner is the first Kardashian woman I can tolerate.
I just learned – to say learned so much from The Daily Show is not even putting it – strongly enough. I was sort of shaped by The Daily Show and just sort of shaped and honed and to think in a certain way and to try to hone in on what is most essential and what is the most cogent irony or hypocrisy or absurdity of a situation. And then to take that and having identified it, try to express it in a way that provokes laughter rather than applause. You know, that applause of like, good point, you know, that's not what you want. You want just people to laugh. There's something very wonderfully demystifying about having to come up with product every day.
Yeah.
It's good. It's good. And it's the opposite of thinking that there's a muse that flies in and whispers in your ear and flies away. That's bullshit.
I don't believe in most of you either.
I mean, I'm very lucky that it worked out this way and that I've found a way to do what many, many, many people have tried and failed to do, which is to monetize my Twitter account.
Right.
I really enjoy the Twitter account. It gives me satisfaction and I enjoy the fact that it's had some success, but it hasn't paid the bills or any bill or a penny.
Like Twitter itself.
Like Twitter itself, from what I understand.
Yeah.
But I can't say there was any plan to it, and I'm sure God would say the same thing.
For Studio 360, I'm Sean Ramos-Firm.
An Act of God is running on Broadway now. And thanks to the godlike Terrence McKnight for playing the voice of God in our story. By the way, you can subscribe to the bi-weekly Sideshow podcast and receive a daily dose of pop culture insight at studio360.org/sideshow. Still ahead this hour, the great young band Braids tells us what prom night is like in Canada.
You know what happens when you put like 150 really drunk high schoolers around a mechanical bull? It's
just have a good time.
Fun and vomit.
Yeah, have so much fun and so much vomit.
Braids plays live right here in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The members of the Canadian band Braids are young, mid-20s, but they started playing together when they were really young, in a sandbox. Austin Tufts' first question to his future bandmate, Raphael Stendel Preston, what kind of belly button do you have? They formed a band in high school, and they have been making music for the decades since. Braids has just released its third album, Deep in the Iris. The music is a mix of acoustic and electronic and infectious beats lashed to smart, poetic lyrics. And they're here now, Raphael, Austin, and their bandmate, Taylor Smith. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks for having us.
Hey.
So you made your first album in a literal garage for $500, and you're Canadian, so that's even less money. has the process changed in the 6 years since then?
It stayed the same in the fact that we still do everything ourselves.
Mm-hmm. We didn't do it in a garage on this last record.
And so talk about where you went. You went all over, right?
Well, yeah, we chose to rent three different sort of rural retreat cabins in the middle of nowhere. One was near Prescott, Arizona, the other near Delhi, New York, and a third near Putney, Vermont. And the idea was to make a lot of noise, feel a sense of connection to nature and our surroundings. And also a big part of what we wanted to do is to have a record that felt a lot more sunny and a lot brighter than previous stuff that we've done. Our last records have been recorded, as you said, first one in a garage, second one in another garage, a different one, but just a box with no windows. And it led to slightly cooler and more insular music, and we wanted to do something that was very expansive.
And I understand there was a special piano involved as well.
Yeah, a very special piano.
Martin's.
Yeah, our friend Martin Crook, him and his family sort of took us in into their home.
Which location?
In Putney, Vermont.
Yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful old home. And they had a 150-year-old Steinway, baby grand, and it was his great-grandmother's. And it creaked and kind of groaned and made some weird squeaks and squeals, and that sound is imparted on the record, you know, that sort of more raw human nature element.
Were you, as you traveled around, were there ever landscapes or places and you said, whoa, this should be a song?
I mean, that was the biggest inspiration for going to Arizona in the first place. Prior to that, we had been touring for 4 years, sort of on and off, and a lot through the southwestern United States. And every time we make that drive from Los Angeles to Phoenix or Santa Fe, any of those areas, it's shocking.
It's like going to another planet.
It's very, very powerful.
I think it was like the great expansiveness of it all and just like how you could look out and your eyes could just follow for a very, very long time.
I think also the sense of like distance from anything else, you know, mm-hmm. where we had created previously was very much like in suburban or urban areas. And there's lots of other things going on and lots to cloud your head.
Yeah.
And also, like, we just the time window where we wanted to start recording happened to fall in the winter, and we just wanted to get out of Montreal in the wintertime and go to somewhere sunny and warm and have that influence the record and its sound.
Well, instead of chatting more right now, let's hear a song from this album, which appropriately, I think, is called Warm Like Summer.
Yes, it is.
Feel like living a lie.
That was Braids performing Warm Like Summer off their new album Deep in the Iris, live right here in Studio 360. I mentioned earlier that you've all been playing together since high school. Who were you in those days? What did you have taped in your lockers? And what did you wear to the prom if you went to the prom?
Austin and I went to prom together.
Mm-hmm.
Austin, we were each other's first love.
Honestly, that prom was pretty good. The after party of their prom was way better than the after party at
a riding bowl,
right?
So fun.
Yeah, there was a mechanical bowl. And, like, you know what happens when you put, like, 150 really drunk high schoolers around a mechanical bowl? It's just
you have a good time.
Fun and vomit.
Yeah, have so much fun and so much vomit.
Do you ever think or worry that being so connected to your high school selves will prevent you from growing up?
Because, like, because we're friends, all still friends?
And still, still being friends and doing this thing you were doing as, dare I say it, children.
No, it's changed so much. I mean, it's really evolved with us.
So much.
Like, we're just very conscious of having the band evolve with our lives and change and adapt to our lives, but then also let it take our lives to different places.
Yeah, I think it's great. I love it. It's like a family.
And what would your high school self say about this record, Deep in the Iris?
I'd be very, very, very proud.
All my favorite records are from the, like, 2 or 3 years in high school, because, like, that's when you're really, like,
affected.
Yeah, affected, yeah, or emotionally really vulnerable. That feeling, that sense of, like, being really willing to invest in art or in music and having emotional experiences with it, that's what we tried to tap into really directly when recording and writing this record. That was the feeling we were trying to capture. Mm-hmm. So I think we'd be really psyched on it.
And well, you should be. Raphael Austin Taylor, thank you very much for joining us here today. And can you play us out with one final song?
Sure.
Sure.
Great. That's Braids performing Taste off their new album Deep in the Iris, which is out now. You can hear a full version of that song and a bonus track they recorded live for us at studio360.org. And, okay, Braids got together in high school, so a reminder, high school. Don't forget to tell the funny teenagers you know that they've got a chance to make BJ Novak laugh and win our humor writing competition. All the details are at studio360.org/funnyhaha. And that's it for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you tune in again next week. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Jenny Lawton,
David Krasnow,
Martha Little,
Matt Fidler,
Sean Ramisferum,
Matt Frassica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Lynn Levy,
Krista Ripple,
Kasia Pila,
Becca Forsman,
Kushelle Stocks,
Dasha Lisitsina,
Jack DeSidoro.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI, Public Radio International.